Accession number 20268, Reel 2.
Ted Hayward, Reel 2.
Yes, we touched down at Kimpo Airfield. They just offloaded us and said we've got to bed down here for the night, for the rest of the night. So we did. We got our sleeping bags off the plane and put our heads down, as it were. And then fairly early in the morning, there was this terrible sound of aircraft and lights. And as it became light, we realised we were in the middle of the airfield. And there was planes taking off and landing either side of us. So we thought, well, God, what are we doing here? We gradually met up with the rest of the regiment. And we assembled in an area, and we discovered that Americans had already taken Seoul. So that part of the campaign was aborted, and we marched into Seoul with the rest of the 8th Corps, as it was.
Which platoon and company were you in the middle?
Started off, I believe it was called C Company, which I was in then at that time of landing in Kimpo, which was known as the Queen's Company, the Queen's Royal Regiment Company at that time, but part of the Middlesex Regiment with her own company sergeant major and platoon officers, etc. But soon after we'd gone through Seoul and we captured Seoul, I was asked to join the machine gun, the MMGs as it was known, company, which was D Company, if I remember rightly. And that was the company I stayed with right through the conflict.
And who was in charge of you in that machine gun?
Lieutenant Norton. Lieutenant Norton. We became great friends during, you know, the conflict. And we kept the carriers going and the various other vehicles. That was one of my responsibilities. And as a result of that, I think we were the only regiment that kept most of our Bren gun carriers going. The Argyles gave up with them in the end, you know, pins severing because of the severe temperatures, molecules of metal moved apart, and because things just sheared, you see. But we kept them going. We had carriers running virtually all night so they didn't freeze. And it was a hard job, but it became a challenge. And Lieutenant Norton, as a result of that, was asked to come back to England before the conflict, before our part of the war had finished, and give lectures on how we kept these carriers going. So we managed to write a few notes so they had something, you know, to talk about. And he came back to England. But that was, you know, we'd been up to the Manchurian border and back before all that happened, of course. And
what did Seoul look like when you first went into it?
Well, it was just a heap of rubble, basically. There was very few buildings left standing. The roads were just full of bomb craters, shell craters. Yes. Very, very sad.
Were there people about?
Yes, refugees begging for food. And because lots of them just laying on the side of the road, dead, of course. Which is a big shock to teenagers to see so much death. It was really sickening, you know, to see that. Did have a profound effect, I think, on the rest of our time in Korea, because we did see so much death. Particularly Americans, where they'd been caught, because you used to have these, which you've probably heard of, the banzais, where North Koreans particularly used to come down early in the morning, because the Americans would be wrapped up in their sleeping bags and no proper guard duty, and they just used to be slaughtered. That was very, very bad. And it was a very daunting sound, because they'd play trumpets, blow trumpets, and scream at the top of their voices as they came down to attack. And a lot of Americans died that way, actually. So virtually in their sleeping bags.
So what is
slaughtered.
What is a banzai?
A banzai means it's a form of, it means a dawn attack. I think that's the definition of it. But it wasn't just the Koreans, this was an oriental thing, goes back centuries apparently.
Did you see the aftermath of any of those massacres?
Oh yes, absolutely. There was one occasion, and this was during our push north, when we had to move the bodies off the roads, if you could call them roads, so that we'd get the vehicles through. It was that bad. Because the Americans weren't very clever in burying their dead. I mean clever, because if you leave your bodies laying around, this gives the enemy the opportunity to count the bodies and say, look, we've killed X amount of people. See, the Chinese used to bury theirs very quickly. Even though it was a very shallow grave, they buried them very quickly, so it was different to count their dead. But the Americans didn't. They just walked away and left it. In fact, I think we probably buried more of their men than they did themselves. We felt obliged to, you know.
You mean you were given orders to...
No, we weren't given orders. It was just something that we'd done. Very bad. I'd say not very clever in terms of intelligence. Because the propaganda was a big thing in Korea, you see. Being a political war, as it was. As I say, then we moved north. At the time we'd reached the 38th parallel, I think most of the Korean army had been taken out completely. You know, there was just guerrilla forces here and there, because the 27th Independent Brigade done most of the mopping up. They went up into the hills and the mountains. The Americans kept to the roads and the lowland. But we were the ones that went up into the hills and ferreted out the pockets of resistance. That was our job. That was our function, really, in Korea, was to go out on these patrols. But to say, when I joined the MMGs, I didn't do any of that. I suppose you could say I got one of the cushier jobs. in terms of that, I wasn't actually involved in the hand-to-hand fighting like a lot of them were at that time. So we carried on, we moved further north, moved into Pyongyang, captured Pyongyang, North Korean capital. And there was the big battle at Icheon, which we weren't involved in at that time. That apparently, well, it was when we went through there later on. Worse devastation than Seoul itself. I think the Americans and the Chinese trying to hold positions there. So, you know, there's a lot of damage there. Anyway, we met, and this to us was quite something. When we moved into North Korea after passing through South Korea, which is just a peasant country really, they had nothing. It's tin shacks and paper houses. And then we moved into North Korea, and as a youngster I could not believe what I was seeing, because we'd heard so much about the terrible communists and they were backward and all the rest of it. And these wonderful big buildings and marvellous big roads, you thought, you know, we've been we've been told that they've got nothing. And we, and our headquarters was the North Korean football ground, and it was massive. I mean, it made Wembley look second class. It was a big stadium. And because stretching across the width of all the main roads going through Pyongyang was the big poster of Stalin. You know, he was everywhere. And that was quite something to see, these very large posters spanning the width of the road of Joe Stalin. And but there was trams, buses, it was incredible. And there wasn't a lot of damage to Pyongyang, funnily enough. It wasn't too bad. I think this was possibly because the Americans didn't have to bomb it too much, because the North Korean army was moving further north. They were just moving out and we were just moving in, basically, you see. Then the winter started to close in, and it got extremely cold. And I remember one morning we woke up and we were absolutely freezing. We just could not get warm, and we were in our sleeping bags. No, they weren't sleeping bags, they were just blankets and a ground sheet. We didn't have sleeping bags then. Ground sheets and a blanket, all covered in snow, and we could hardly move through the cold. We were there with jungle green uniforms on, the start of winter. Most of the vehicles wouldn't start on this particular occasion, because all the fuel had formed ice around the fuel, the carburetors and the fuel pipes, so nothing would start. It would light fires underneath these vehicles to get them mobile. And it got so bad after about a week that people started going down with frostbite and exposure. And then we heard through the grapevine that Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister, has given an ultimatum to Washington that if the Americans could not supply us with Arctic equipment, he would have to pull the whole of the British Commonwealth contingent out of Korea. It was that serious. Because there was nowhere where we had Arctic equipment in that part of the world to get it to us in time. So the Americans must have ummed and ahed for a little while, and then within a few days suddenly all this Arctic equipment arrived, just in time really, because we were in serious trouble. So the British uniforms disappeared, and for all intents and purposes, outwardly anyway, we looked like Americans. And then as our equipment, rifles etc., started to break down, we were even using American arms, like their carbines, in place of the 303 rifles and automatics and revolvers. I think everyone had a 45 automatic before the end of our term in Korea anyway. And a few had the Colt 45s, like a Western type, which the officers had, particularly in the 1st Cavalry Division. So there we were. But we did manage to keep our boots, our British boots, and because they were far superior to the American boots, they looked very nice, they were suede, but after a while they just gave up, you know, they'd split. But the British boots were fantastic. And the Americans were always trying to get hold of British boots. And then eventually we got proper Arctic boots, which I think were Canadian. They were pigskin, with a lot more studs in the bottom. And they were very good. But the main piece of clothing, which I think saved us from the intense cold, was the string vest. That was an amazing invention, because what that done, that circulated the heat of the body and stopped the over vest from touching the skin, because when you cool down, that the perspiration would freeze in certain temperatures. I mean, we had minus 30 degrees C, so that's pretty cold. And the Americans were suffering this, where their vests were freezing to their skin and just pulling the flesh off their bodies. So that was an amazing piece of equipment. But it didn't stop people getting frostbite and exposure. And I suffered with that. I walked about silly, really. Walked around probably 2 or 3 days, and I just couldn't feel my feet at all. I thought, oh, they'll come round. But I had the beginnings of frostbite in the end. And as the medics dealt with that, a special solution. And I keep rising the temperature gradually, so that the blood starts to flow and eventually come around. I was lucky. I didn't lose any toes or a couple of toenails, that was all. But the pain was, I think I passed out. Well, I knew I passed out completely with the pain on that occasion. But I've never done that again. Silly thing to do.
But what had you done to provoke it?
Well, it's just sheer cold, just sheer exposure, you know, to the intense cold. Because early on we didn't have any tents at all. We just had to put your sleeping bags, as we got then, down on the snow on a ground sheet or something, and that was it. But eventually the Americans issued us with the bivouac tent. That was a 2-man bivouac, and it wasn't too bad. So well, unfortunately, because what used to happen, we used to erect the tents if you were in an area for some time and it snowed, so it became like an igloo, and because you get the frost, which was quite severe, and that would just freeze everything, so you could never remove that bivouac that was there. It was just frozen to the ground, so you had to get another issue, fill in the ship and get another bivouac. But anyway, we carried on with the push. As we went along the main roads, we had problems with ordinary peasants carrying armaments, all sorts of things under their clothing. So one of our jobs was to carry out these roadblocks, and we had to search all the civilians, virtually strip them naked, because they would carry arms in between their legs, strapped to their waist, you see, as a form of infiltration to our lines. So we had to search them, which wasn't a very nice thing in the intense cold. But that's what had to be done. And every morning you would see literally hundreds of women, children, old people frozen to death on the side of the roads. Terrible. I suppose they walked until they dropped, and that was it. And apparently I read somewhere where there was more civilians killed or died of exposure in Korea, in the Korean conflict, than there was during the Second World War. And that doesn't surprise me.
Did you ever find any arms on civilian?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did. Yes. Hand grenades, anti-personnel devices. Obviously, they were going to lay mine. And the mines were wooden casings. So very difficult to detect. Yes, and have all those sort of things. Firearms. Yeah.
So what happened to the civilian who was caught with weapons?
Well, they were interrogated. They were handed over to sometimes the ROK people. Now, this is the Korean army, and they were terrible towards them. In fact, there was one occasion where we'd handed over three of they were a tank crew, which had been, the tank had been knocked out. And we captured these three of the crew. They were dressed in civilian clothes, but underneath they had their uniforms on, so they had their military underpants, so we knew. And so we handed them over to the South Korean officer, and they were hustled into this lorry, and he was beating them about the head with a rifle butt. Yeah, to get them to talk. So we tried to stop that. But one of our officers came out and said, well, you can't interfere. They've been handed over officially. And so it's not your problem any longer. But it was degrading to see what they were doing. It really was. So that wasn't very nice at all. That was a sad part. But then we carried on, and I remember another occasion where we'd come to this village north of Pyongyang, and there was two big banks there, and the banks, all the vaults had been blown open, and there was just, well, must have been millions of banknotes and bonds and things. In fact, I've got a couple of bonds which I picked up, and there was a lot of that, but all that had to be set light to, and so we had to destroy all that sort of currency, you see. And then we carried on moving up towards Manchuria, the Manchurian border. And the winter was getting worse and worse, and it was difficult to determine what was a bridge and what was just a bank of snow which had been used as a bridge. Because most of the rivers by then were frozen solid, so you could actually move all your armoured vehicles right across the river without the bridges anyway. And when the ice was about 20 foot thick. So that's how most of the mechanized forces moved, was just crossing the rivers, because most of the bridges had been destroyed anyway. And then we reached the Manchurian border, and we could see the power stations in the distance. And we held our positions there for some time. The Americans were dropping like flies with the cold, and the Australians as well. They couldn't handle the severe temperatures, and it was getting very serious because no one knew what the next move was. We were just sitting there, and then we got the message that the conflict was going to be extended into China, and there was talk of them using the atom bomb by General MacArthur. And we thought, well, this is quite a frightening situation. if we go into China, that's it. You know, we'll never see home again. This was just a view of a teenager, you know, looking at, well, I'm never gonna get back home again. And I remember our parson, a military padre, he just broke down. He just had a complete mental breakdown, which wasn't very helpful, because he was the person that was supposed to keep our morale at a certain level, but he just broke down completely, and they had to take him away. And then, because the Chinese started their offensive, and then I think in one of those books which I have, it says one of the biggest military retreats in history. And we were, the 27th Brigade was detailed to handle all the rear guard actions. So we had to hold the lines to allow all the United Nations forces to get well behind the lines. So we were always the last. In fact, in some occasions, we could see the Chinese moving in our direction. You know, 10 minutes after we'd moved out of an area, they'd moved in. And that was the situation. It was like a political maneuver. And this is how it prevailed right the way through, back across the 38th parallel, with odd conflicts occurring, because the winter was very bad by then, and negotiating mountain passes caused major problems with vehicles going over the top. But because the snow had built up certain ridges, and you've got 1,000 feet or more drop one side, the tendency is to get away from that edge, and then you start this sort of sliding effect, because the vehicles start doing this, and eventually they go straight over.
Going from side to side?
Yes, because you're trying to virtually climb the side of the mountain, and every time that happens, you're building up this very slippery bank on the mountain side. And because several vehicles in front of me, I remember, just went over the top. You know, it was really bad. So we carried on, and that prevailed for several weeks. And when we finally came to cross back over the 38th parallel, I always remember this. It was this big red sign, and the wording on it went something like this: "You are crossing the 38th parallel with the compliments of the Chinese Communist Army," which was quite a peculiar statement. And to this day, I don't know who actually put that up there, but it was a big red board. So we carried on, and eventually we stopped, because I think there's a lot of political manoeuvring occurring at that time between the United Nations and the Chinese and Russian government, as to what was going to happen, because they were looking for a political settlement. So we stopped just outside Seoul. It was getting very near Christmas then. I think it must have been, or perhaps 2 weeks before Christmas. And that's where we were going to stop.